Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. Regularly throughout this year, we've been blessed with thoughtful recommendations from many of our favourite writers, critics, and thinkers from the world of culture. On today's episode, we're tapping into that combined wisdom once again to bring you a roundup of the best of what 2023 had to offer. We're covering books, film, and music, from a novel that follows a history teacher on a road trip with the great lost love of his life, to animated superheroes and the surprise album from a triple Grammy-nominated band. And here with those recommendations, and many more besides, are the arts journalists Andrew Mayle, The Guardian's deputy music editor Laura Snapes, and the film critic Leila Latif. Welcome all to the programme. Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
In pre-Christmas roundup mode. Andrew, we're going to start with you. Welcome back to the programme.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be back.
We're in kind of quick fire round today. But nonetheless, we're going to lean on some of your wisdom. We're talking about books with Andrew today. And your first choice is a much fancy one this year. It was recommended by mutual friend of ours, I think, John Mitchinson, earlier in the year. And that is Claire Dederer's Monsters. What floated your boat about this year, Andrew?
Just the way Dederer is, she's an American critic and essayist, and she's intelligent and witty. And Monsters is this brilliant mix of memoir and treatise, I suppose, in which he asks, what do you do with the art of monstrous people? Phil Spector, Michael Jackson, Roman Polanski, Virginia Woolf, Woody Allen, J.K. Rowling. Can you hate the artists but still love the art? And the thing that's nice about it is it's a very playful, self-reflexive series of essays. And at the heart of it is Dederer's own relationship with these complicated and mostly male artists whose, to quote her, is whose behaviour disrupts our ability to apprehend their work. She analyses the notion of the monstrous female artist, the negligent mother, and cliches like that. And she asks whether, you know, artists, awful people are driven to greatness, to artistic greatness, to make up for their loathsomeness. But ultimately, this is a book that kind of resists any grand unified intellectual theory. And it allows the reader, the consumer, you and me, to just kind of have space to revel in the beauty and grandeur and strangeness of great art made by bad people, on the understanding, ultimately, that liking it doesn't make you a bad person. And perhaps more importantly, casting it aside doesn't automatically make you a good person. Mm-hmm. So it kind of allows you to engage with these complicated areas between the, you know, the creator and the object, the work of art that they create.
I guess she's vacillating in between separating the art from the artist. Does she treat everybody equally in this kind of list of books?
People have criticised the book. I read reviews of the book at the time saying, where are the answers? There are no answers. Then, you know, as if like people wanted a kind of a template that you placed on every book and every film so you could kind of go along and go, tick good, tick bad. And it's like, okay, right, great, fine, now I can watch Annie
Which
Hall.
DVDs yeah, to take off the shelf.
Exactly. Yeah. And she doesn't do that because she realises that what you're doing is you're immersed in these works. You're engaged with it. It's an ongoing process. And I think to present definite answers would be disingenuous. And also, she's smart enough to admit that it's dependent on the quality of the art. So basically saying it's easier to dismiss the Cosby Show than it is to dismiss the works of Picasso. You know, yeah, it's not just based on the degree of awfulness that is inherent in the creator. It's also a cultural question of how much you value the art that they created.
That is Monsters by Claire Dederer. Andrew, thank you very much. Laura, we're going to kick off music with you. We're going to have a clip. This is Eddie Chacon from Eddie Chacon's new record. This is a bit of Holy Hell. Some collaborative nodding here in Studio One.
we didn't hear the beginning of that song, but it has the greatest drum intro I've heard in forever. I could listen to just that bit on a loop. That's definitely the peppiest song on the album. Mm-hmm. Eddie Chacon, people might not know the name, but you would probably know Charles and Eddie's Would I Lie to You, the big 90s hit. They had quite a bit of success then, but then in the early 2000s, Charles died and Eddie pursued a career in photography. He said that he didn't want to be a sort of washed up heritage act, and the idea of doing something like Eddie Chacon plays Motown absolutely appalled him. But then he kind of had the idea that he wanted to get back into music, and somebody put him in touch with John Carroll Kirby, who's this like brilliant LA producer who's worked with people like Solange and the Brainfeeder crew. And he had his comeback solo album, I think in 2019. Andrew will know better because I discovered him because of Andrew's interview with him for The Guardian called Pleasure, Joy and Happiness.
Different sort of nodding along to that.
Yeah, vigorous. I would say that album is even a bit more sort of like colourful and present than this one. This one is so spectral. I mean, that song is absolutely fantastic, but it's a bit of a misnomer for the rest of the record. It's like ghostly soul music with barely there wisps of lyrics about mortality. It reminds me of the sort of music that you would listen to if you were lucky enough to own a Frank Lloyd Wright bungalow, but you were actually very sad in spite of being able to own a Frank Lloyd Wright bungalow, drinking a cocktail and sort of shuffling.
Maybe you'd inherited it from
maybe
someone
you
that you wished was still there.
And you can't afford the upkeep, and you wish they were still there. But you're drinking a cocktail and shuffling very slowly on the carpet. It's very soulful and like sensual in a really unobvious way. He's an amazing performer as well.
Obviously, Eddie Chacon brings out the best in reviewers. Thank you for that that pithy sentiment, Laura Snopes. I would like to refer listeners back to Andrew's review. I think this was of his earlier album when he described it as crap's last tape via Channel Orange. Yeah. So it brings out the excellent metaphor in all music writers as well. So he literally hung up his microphone and his song and put his lawyer's pad for his songwriting purposes back in a cupboard and became a creative director, I understand, between Charles and Eddie
and photographer. Yeah, so it's almost, you know, 20 years in the wilderness, really. Yeah.
And we had John Carroll Kirby on this programme earlier this year. He's a very good chat, but I love his work. His sort of wonky soul funk sort of stuff. It's all slightly different stuff. And his voice, Eddie Chacon's voice, are we in sort of classic soul territory, I wonder, with this? Or are we in sort of wispier, are we more suggestive, gauzier sort of territory with his vocals?
Yeah, definitely wispier, ghostier. I mean, he's not that old, but there's a real, like, you know, veil of mortality that hangs over these records. And maybe it's because of the loss of Charles, I'm not sure where entirely it comes from. But the first time I saw him live at Le Guess Who Festival a few years ago, he was quite a sort of spectral, uncertain-seeming figure. But then I saw him at the Church of Sound in London around this time last year, actually, and he was much more into it. And he had a bit more, like, razzle-dazzle going on. You can see he was wearing a vest with a lovely see-through grey starry top on top. So he was getting into it.
He'd got his glittery curtains, at least nominally, behind him. Yeah. That is the album Sundown by the returning Eddie Chacon. Thank you very much for that, Laura. Film time, Layla. Hi, Layla.
Hey.
And we're starting with Saint-Omer. This is a fascinating sort of premise for a film. What did this do in the summer?
It is a fascinating premise. The story behind it is absolutely unbelievable one. Essentially, Alice Diop, the writer and director of this film, was a documentarian. She's made incredible documentaries for years. And she was kind of struck by the story that she saw in the newspaper one day about this Senegalese immigrant who had been accused of leaving her little baby on the beach and allowing the tide to come in and drown her. And she kind of became convinced that, like, you know, all these racist press, they can't be reporting this, right? Mm. This must be some sort of, you know, misunderstanding and some terrible injustice about to happen. So she went and she sat through the trial. It's a lot more complicated than she could imagine. So at the end of it, she decided to make her first fiction feature, I suppose a loosely fictionalized version of events. And so, yeah, Saint-Omer, where terrible things happen to very complicated women.
It's an amazing thing. And I understand that it has something to do with, this was not the intention of the mother, or is this the intention of the filmmaker, that this kind of riffs on the myth of Medea?
Yeah, very much riffing on the myth of Medea, but I think the kind of reading that Diop's proxy Rama comes to the trial with is that she's about to see kind of how, you know, this woman is like a victim of a Jason, like Medea was a victim of someone else. Yeah. But the reality is a lot more brutal, and it's all about kind of feeling dispossessed and lonely and mental illness and the way that, you know, black women in France are kind of isolated, not just from their community, but kind of from their own like sense of self, I suppose.
Yeah. So the filmmaker was a documentary maker before she was a feature filmmaker. And making a film about something that really happened and going to a courtroom and all the rest of it, how much does it lean on its on her own documentary roots, stylistically?
You know, not very. I mean, there's a lot of kind of very well-written monologues that are delivered. Mm-hmm. It kind of all crescendos on
there is
this
a Greek chorus then of sorts.
There is. Like, yeah, it, I mean, I don't think you'd guess that, like, those were the roots of it. I didn't even really understand that it had any kind of basis in reality whilst I was watching it. It was kind of a stunning twist that happened in the press notes afterwards. But yeah, no, she sort of reimagines things. So you have like the barrister for the defence giving like a speech that just, you know, feels like it could have been written by Shakespeare. And like the whole purpose of it is not to be like, this is what happened, but kind of what she wished had happened.
Right. It's been a good year for French courtroom dramas, right? Anatomy of a Fall.
It has, yeah.
It's been good. Those guys, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of
breaking the conventions.
To be a woman in the French justice system, it's not enviable.
What
this
lot?
Year.
Yeah, no. And also, this we should point out, this won the Grand Jury Prize at Venice. It's Layla's choice. It's Saint-Omer. Thanks very much, Layla. Andrew, coming back to you and books. Sebastian Barry, always wonderful, was on form again this year with Old God's Time. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Sebastian Barry, Dublin-born novelist, playwright, poet, multi-garlanded, twice shortlisted for the Booker, twice winner of the Costa, and his books are regularly recommended to me. But this is the first one I've actually finished, as I often find his books very rich, very overflowery, kind of very much about kind of, oh, what a beautifully constructed sentence, Sebastian. And at first glance, this is quite a straightforward book about a retired police officer, D.S. Tom Kettle, living alone on the Dublin coast in a crumbling lean-to next to a Victorian castle, surviving on the memories of his late wife and his two children also dead. And then he's called back to the force to help in a cold case investigation of a murdered priest. So it begins like a classic crime
novel. A bit of genre,
yeah. Yeah, the old detective called back for one last job. But the difference is that Tom is an unreliable subject. He's prone to evasions, forgetfulness and disinformation. Some of the characters he meets and that we meet may be memories or ghosts. And gradually, some of his darkest memories and those of Ireland itself begin to rise to the surface. So you'll notice when I talk about the Laurie Moore book, there's a theme that is developing here. This kind of the Old God's Time is a hazy, dreamlike, unstable book. And it's kind of while it's moving forward, it's also unraveling. And so it's reworking and picking apart, you know, kind of crime genre tropes, but also kind of it's a book about Ireland, about memory and loss and trauma, where the prose, it's almost like the prose is being used as a means to keep people's memories alive.
He's sort of geographically, he's sort of on the edge of things, isn't he?
He rents a cottage
on the edge of the sea and he kind of ruminates, and it's got a kind of, there's a bit of an Iris Murdoch kind of vibe there.
And there's a sense of kind of entropy and lassitude to it as well, this idea of things falling away and trying to sort of retain and hold on to things that are falling away. And it's kind of one of those books that's sort of, it's so rich and it works on so many levels.
Yeah, I feel like you can't see the joins in his work. Actually.
Absolutely
I love,
not.
I love that. It's just like he's sort of capturing it from the ether kind of thing.
Yes.
That is Sebastian Barry's Old God's Time. Thank you, Andrew. Laura, we're coming to you. We're very much in the world of memory and evocation of memory. And this is Julie Byrne. Should we have a clip from Summer Glass before we chat about Julie Byrne's RP?
Spun the page.
vocals of Julie Byrne. Laura, this comes from a very tender place of memory as well, I suppose, this record.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So this is Julie Byrne's third album. The first one was sort of a cassette release that then got sort of discovered more widely. And then Not Even Happiness a few years ago was the first time she kind of really, you know, peeked into the public eye. And then this new album, it was quite a long time in the making because she'd always made music with her collaborator, Eric Littman, who's a musician in his own right. And they had started making this record together and they were long-term friends, sort of more than best friends is how I think they would describe it. Like, they had been romantic partners early on, but then they just had this really kind of transcendent friendship that he died in the middle of its making. So then the record was shelved for ages. And, you know, I interviewed her and she described the kind of horrifyingly intimate process of having to go into his computer and find the files that they had been working on. They were the only people who had ever heard them. And then she ultimately finished a record with a guy called Alex Summers, who was in a duo with John Z from Sigur Rós. Mm-hmm. I think there were 9 songs on the album and 8 of them were written before Eric's passing. And then one called Death is the Diamond, the last song, was written afterwards. But I find this happens quite often in, maybe it's just coincidence, but where, not that she in any way was sort of foretelling his death or anything like that, but the original songs that she wrote, he had things that he had told her about the meaning of true friendship. And there's a really great song called Conversation is a Flow State, which she told me was something that he said to her, just this perfect aphorism that he came out with when she described feeling misused in a relationship. Yeah, the sound of it is unbelievable. It's so transcendent. It seems to be cast kind of in halo light. Like that clip that we just heard, I think is amazing. There's so many bits I love in it. Her voice is sort of like Nico, but with a real tenderness to it, maybe. Mm. Like there's a caress in there. And then one of the lyrics in the bit that we heard, she sings, "You lit my joint with the end of your cigarette." Just like these little intimacies that she sings about.
Yeah.
And the way that the synths and the harp cascade together in that song, it reminds me of sort of a moment in a Disney cartoon where you see a regular mortal kind of being elevated into the heavens with stars swirling around them or something in this moment of transformation. And it is a record that's tinged with grief, but also in the way, in a way that's about grief sort of teaching you why love is worth it and sort of, yeah, remembering all the things that it's taught her. It's not a melancholy record. I mean, I do find parts of it very sad and very beautiful, but yeah, it's really transcendent, I think.
It seems to do a lot with not a lot, in a way. It doesn't have a huge amount of instrumentation to push you emotionally one way or another. It's just in her vocals and in that very light instrumentation that seems to work hard, and her lyrics are such a part of that, I suppose. And that voice, as you say.
Yeah.
Sort of close mic, but not cheaply so. You know what I mean? You know, you can sing like that. You can sing that way for effect, and it seems very, very heartfelt.
Her earliest recordings, like her songwriting was a bit more naturalistic, but then there comes a point kind of around Not Even Happiness where it kind of takes on this metaphysical quality, and I think that really comes through in this record as well. I could not recommend this enough.
Beautifully put. It's Julie Byrne's The Greater Wings. Thank you, Laura. Layla, we're going to the Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
Let's hear a bit of the trailer as Miles tries to balance being Spider-Man and being teenager with parents to answer to.
My name is Miles Morales. I'm Brooklyn's one and only Spider-Man. And things are going great.
Oh, yeah. You were supposed to be here at 5.
All right, whatever.
Whatever?
Wow.
Whatever?
So are you like a cow or a Dalmatian?
I am the Spot.
That's not funny. Don't do that.
Miles's grades are pretty good. A in AP Physics.
That's my little man.
And a B in Spanish.
What?
Ooh, okay.
Miles.
Are you trying
Mira, to kill that's what I'm
I gotta go. All right, bye.
Layla, this received such a lot of love from unusual quarters, you might say, this summer. So many people went to see this that don't have kids, that don't necessarily love animated films. Yeah. It seemed to float a lot of boats. Tell us a bit about why this was special this summer.
Well, on paper, it's everything that's wrong with the film industry in one film. I mean, it's a sequel, there's multiverses, you hear the reports of like the number of thousands of people that were near worked to death to create it, to do all the animation, 2 writers, 3 directors. Like, this should be like the absolute nadir of culture. But it's so, so good. It's so charming, and so much thought has gone into every single frame. I mean, the first one was pretty well received, where we kind of had different versions of Spider-Man all coming to Miles's Brooklyn. And in this one, he's going into other versions of the Spider-Man universe. So we kind of see a Mumbai version of Spider-Man. We see a kind of a futuristic one. There's a really beautiful one that Gwen Stacy's Spider-Woman populates, where everything's done kind of like watercolor pop art.
Right.
And everything reacts based on her emotions around her. And it's just gorgeous and beautifully animated.
There is a use for the metaverse after all.
Yeah, I mean, every every other version just so pales in comparison to this. And like, you see like the sludgy CGI nonsense of like half of them, and you just wish that one iota as much care went into them as did into the Spider-Verse.
So this is about the quality of the drawing and the kind of love and care and attention and detail that goes into each frame. Story-wise, things about multiverses can leave audiences scratching their heads despite winning Oscars. How does that, presumably that shows up perfectly well as well then?
I think because, I mean, even when you have loads of multiverses, and I think to a certain degree with those things, you just have to accept it and, like, you know, take a leap of faith with it as a concept. There's such a kind of strong core idea here where essentially the film is looking at, like, does trauma have to be part of a superhero origin story? Like, do we actually need to suffer in order to become our best selves? And, you know, I think when you have it kind of grounded in like a really strong concept, like, I'll accept multiverses and watches and way too many cameos, but still delightful.
And what does this, because this is a Marvel film, it's an animated film, does this signal a new direction, the quality of this, the love for this? Does this start Marvel, I wonder, thinking in a different direction in terms of not having, you know, six big name actors all kind of duking it out to be the funniest, have the best one-liners? Does it feel like an animated universe more and more, I wonder?
I hope so, but I think it's more kind of the intelligence of it, which I hope that the other ones will adopt. I mean, there's been a really significant trend this year that those big superhero films are not getting the box office that they once got. Those Disney Plus shows, like, you know, barely making a blip and costing something like, I believe it was $20 million an episode for She-Hulk.
Right.
They're only half an hour. That's a lot. I think our day rates
could all learn.
But yeah, I think very possibly there's a new direction for this, because this critically adored box office was amazing. And I think, yeah, there's an idea that people won't just show up for any old thing anymore.
Thank you, Layla. That was the wonderful Spider-Verse 2. Andrew, we're going to come back to you and the Laurie Moore that you teed up when you were talking about the Sebastian Barry, just vaguely. And this is I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home. We're in haunting territory again.
Yeah, I think this is my... The other books are great, but this is my book of the year. Laurie Moore's probably best known for her ironic, aphoristic short stories, wisecracking female heroines. She's a writer adept at finding darkness in humour and humour in darkness. Her work is kind of uncanny, I think, in all senses of that word. And this is a deeply uncanny short novel. It's about a road trip in which a teacher, Finn, leaves the hospice bedside of his dying brother to visit the grave of his ex-girlfriend, Lily, a former laugh therapist, hello, Laurie, with your ironies, who has taken her own life. What happens next is kind of unlikely, or maybe I should say unearthly. He finds Lily undead and wandering the graveyard, leaves in her hair, some dirt in her mouth, death adjacent, as she explains to him. And she asks to be taken to a body farm in Tennessee where she could be used for forensic research. That description may not suggest that this is one of the best comic novels I've ever read. The road trip is hallucinatory and disorientating. It's described in language that is also hallucinatory and disorientating, but also utterly luminous and funny and beautiful. It runs parallel with a series of letters from the owner of a 19th century boarding house written to her dead sister about a lodger who might also be the famous assassin of an American president. So you have these two...
There's some sort of bardo going on, some sort of multiverse going on.
Well, I'd say if George Saunders had written this book, he would be... People would be battering down his door to hand him awards, you know. But as the road trip continues, the book starts to... Well, like Lily, the book starts to degrade and burst at the seams. But in this utterly lyrical fashion. And so the book describes how she is starting to rot and decay. But also somehow this is described in loving terms and almost like the kind of, you know, the stuff of a love story. There's references to Homer and Orpheus and William Faulkner and conspiracy theories and the death of America. So it's a book. It's a book about death. It's a book about loss. It's also, in a way, like the Sebastian Barry book, it's a book about how we use narrative to hold together the memories of those that we've lost, you know.
Yeah.
But it's done in such... I mean, I've, I I know people say all the time, I've never read a book like this. But I genuinely have never read a book like this. It's just, it's a magic trick.
So this is sort of, this is ultimate style. This is a book written in a style that is the style almost the plot. The style is doing a job that style normally wouldn't, maybe.
No, because sometimes when you say that, it suggests something where style overwhelms everything else. But the style is so full of heart and love and wit, because often the style is in the dialogue between, you know, our two characters, between Finn and between Lily as they drive together, because they used to love each other. They used to be kind of a couple. And so there is a bond there.
Beautifully put, Andrew. I am homeless if this is not my home. And it's by Laurie Moore. Thank you very much. Laura, Laugh Track by The National. Is this an ironic title?
It might be.
Well, while our listeners are ruminating on that, we're going to have a little bit of Smoke Detector. Hang it on a hanger, put it in the closet. You know where it is whenever you need it. It'll make a good argument. Admit it. You don't know how much I love you. Do you? You don't know how much I love you. That was a little bit of Smoke Detector from The Laugh Track by The National. I've called it The Laugh Track. I always do this. I always add a the onto everything. Well, I'm only 46. I don't know what's happened. Anyway, it's fine. We'll skate over that. It was a good year and a busy one for The National.
This was their second album of the year. It was a surprise album. So sort of at the end of 2019 and then into 2020, their frontman Matt Berninger had basically a breakdown, and he had total writer's block, and he didn't know if the band were even going to be able to continue. The band is made up of two sets of brothers plus him, and there's always been a lot of fractious relationships within the band. But I think for the first time, they really sort of like closed ranks around him and made sure that, you know, prioritised his well-being. It didn't matter if there was a record or not. They just wanted to help like their brother, because they've been together for such a long time, get better. And then out of that period, they made two albums, which I would say real returns to form. Look, I have to put my hands up and say I am a card-carrying National fan. I have seen them 34 times live. Three of them were in September this year.
Whoa.
But you know, their last album before the pandemic, 2019's I Am Easy to Find, I did not really like that record. I think there's maybe two or three good songs on it. It was too cluttered with guest vocalists and too fussy in the arrangements. But these feel not quite like Back to Basics, but you can hear a lot of what people originally loved about The National in them, sort of the desperate self-scrutiny of a record like Alligator, or sort of like the mordant elegies of something like Boxer. And the first one, the first album that came out this year was in spring. It's called First Two Pages of Frankenstein.
Great name for an album.
Really good, yeah. He's, Matt Berninger said he related to kind of the monster in that record. And that's a more gentle album. They made them all at the same time, with the exception of Smoke Detector, which is a song that came together on stage in a sound check. Although the songs were written at the same time, you can slightly divide them into two camps. Like the ones that are on the album that came out earlier this year are more gentle. That's a more fragile record and it's shorter. Matt said that he didn't want to immerse people in that sad, desperate headspace for too long. But then the songs that are on Laugh Track, they are more wide-ranging. They're more adventurous. Some of them are rockier. I mean, the title track, Laugh Track, is one of the most beautiful, gentle songs they've ever made. It's their third collaboration, I think, with Phoebe Bridgers. And the concept is like a couple whose life is in ruins, but he sings like, let's put on the Laugh Track, let's see if it changes the scene. This idea of like, what if this was a sitcom? Would it feel different? But they go to so many different places on this record, and it's got this feeling of like, you know, Brian Devendorf, he's one of the best drummers in indie rock, but he's played like Electric Drum Machine for their past few records. And here he's back on a proper kit, really, really driving it. And the record's got this like mutinous driving feel, but also lightheaded in parts as well. It's sort of like you're being swept out to sea on some kind of terrible tide and you don't care, you're just going with it. But yeah, that song Smoke Detector, it's 8 minutes long. We heard a tiny fraction of it. There have been days this year where I've listened to it for several hours on a loop, which probably says as much about the quality of the song as it does about my headspace.
Laura, thank you for talking us through The National's Laugh Track this year. Layla, coming up next, it's your last movie choice, and it is the movie Elephant in the Room, one half of it anyway. It is Oppenheimer. And let's start with a clip.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
You're the great improviser, but this, you can't do in your head.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world, chances are near zero. Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
A little bit of Oppenheimer to take us into the ineluctable log flume of the awards season. That was right at the beginning of the season, I suppose. A smash hit film about a nuclear physicist. How is it allowed to happen?
Well, I mean, it happens because Christopher Nolan is extremely good at his job and always comes in under budget. So I think they give him a lot more of a free rein than most people get. But yeah, it's his, he left Warner Brothers and now made this with Universal, which I've got some conspiracy theories as to why Warner Brothers then put Barbie on the same weekend. But it, but yeah, it worked out well for both of them because they just did incredibly at the box office. But I think the real kind of going into awards season, the one that's going to sweep it is Oppenheimer, because it is utterly spellbinding, brilliant. I'm so glad that it's now topped Bohemian Rhapsody as the biggest biopic of all time, because that was a number one that really could not stand. It's adapted from the book American Prometheus, which is a non-fiction book, and it kind of looks at Oppenheimer, kind of starts off with him as a kind of student having a very difficult time at Cambridge, where he's kind of gone from America because he wants to be at the real frontier of physics, which is happening in Europe at the time. And then later on, when World War II breaks out, he kind of gathers all of the great and good of American physics, and they go out to New Mexico and they build the atom bomb, which is where you'd think it would end. But no, but then McCarthyism happens. So, yes.
Yeah, it does. It sort of goes in another direction with the, I guess, the subplot, which is Robert Downey Jr.'s character. And it seems to do quite a lot of things. It spins a couple of plates, at least, doesn't it? It doesn't just tell the story of Oppenheimer's scientific work, but it tells the story of his kind of dismantling almost, or attempted dismantling by the American state that he served as well. It's doing quite a lot. Do you feel the same about it? You came in to talk about this in the summer, I believe, actually.
I did,
do you feel the same about it? It sounds like you love it more now than you did then, if that's possible, actually.
I do, because I think it's something that kind of, the more you think about it, the stronger it becomes. Like the whole journey that Oppenheimer has, where he's kind of so conflicted and he tries to kind of view himself as just a cog in like a wider machine, so he can't really be held responsible for it. And then that's sort of contrasted with what he goes through with Robert Downey Jr., where essentially he's kind of made one rude joke and one petty man has decided to kind of reshape history.
Leila, thank you so much for talking us through Oppenheimer there. My thanks also, of course, to Laura Snapes on music and Andrew Mayle on the best of this year's books. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. We will be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.